States on the internet. I want to make sure that they know where they are. My name is Mark Perez. Hugh Ross is not here today, so I'm standing in for Hugh Ross. And before I get on to what we're going to be talking about, I would like to introduce a video, a new video called Reconciling Genesis and Science. And it says that the Genesis of creation account has long been ridiculed by skeptics as scientific nonsense. But what this brief overview does, Hugh Ross responds to this by highlighting the narrative credibility of the Genesis text in light of ongoing scientific discovery. And he shows it with empirical evidence, not just with theological evidence. So this is $10 in the back, and it would be good for anybody who's looking at giving something to somebody else who is curious about what the evidence for the parity of science in the Bible are, to give them this. Okay, I apologize for my throat. I will be drinking copiously. So what are we going to be talking about today? And on the slide behind me, there's a depiction of Darwin with his hand over his mouth, and then a sketch off to the side. That sketch actually was the sketch that, the only sketch, by the way, in The Origin of the Species. And it was the sketch that Darwin himself drew out in his notebook, and he was trying to represent his ideas as he was coming up with the notion of evolution. What we're going to talk about today is a couple of things. First, what is evolution really? We use the term frequently, and some people will, particularly in the Christian world, will say, well, evolution's just merely a theory, and it's bogus, and it's counter to the Bible. And then other people on the other side will say, well, no, it's a fact. It's really true. It's not even questioned. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at what evolution claims to be, and then I'm going to be asking some of you some of your ideas on it, as well as giving you some ideas on some of the ways that the theory of evolution has changed or evolved since 1859 when Darwin posited his notions. So the first thing I'd like to do is give us an idea of what the basic elements of the theory of evolution are. Now, if you ask most people what the definition of the theory of evolution is, or what are its criteria, they come up with something very straightforward. Something like, well, it's the change of the species through time from some last universal common ancestor. And that this change occurs gradually, and the change occurs substantially throughout all of life. Natural selection, which is the process of killing things off that aren't fit to survive, is the thing that helps move or guide or direct evolution. And that's not terribly bad as a definition, but there's a lot more to it than that. So one of the things that I want to do is get through some of the little technical points that would be helpful as we talk about evolution. So first, one element of the theory of evolution is that there is a change of inheritable characteristics of living organism populations over time. So what's an inheritable characteristic? Well, it's anything that you can inherit from your parents. That's all it is, an inheritable characteristic. And it's when we talk about evolution, what we're really talking about is populations. Not just individuals, even though individuals comprise populations. But we need to focus on populations whenever we think about evolution. The reason I emphasize this so much is I've heard people say, well, I'd like to see a fish turn into a bird, okay, as a proof that evolution is true. Well, that's nonsense. Even the evolution theorist wouldn't ever believe that to happen. It occurs in populations very slowly. Variations of these characteristics exist in populations at any given time. So typically, you'll have a population of a species or a genus or whatever, and there'll be variations within that population, color or the thickness of the skin or whatever it is that there are. So there's various characteristics that identify a particular creature. There are variations. Just so if we were to look in this room, look at the variations of the humans that are sitting in this room. Okay, those are various characteristics. Survivor populations pass on their characteristics and continue to change. So I use the term survivor because obviously if the group or population that you're in dies because the environment kills you, you're not a survivor population. So the survivor populations will continue to change as they live through time. And then one of the key things is that this began with a last universal common ancestor or ancestors. We'll get more into that in a minute, but this is a very important point for evolution theorists of all shapes and sizes, regardless of their viewpoint. There is the belief that because all the variations occur from heritable or inheritable traits, that they had to have come from some original person, or original creature, not original person. So some last universal common ancestor, or possibly there were several. They don't know. At least they don't even know theoretically. So as you look at these four characteristics or these four themes, these are what an evolutionist of any type would agree on. So these are the things that evolution does not dispute. Actually, these are the things that some people who aren't evolutionists do dispute. If you were to look at this, and you were to look at this just from a Christian perspective, which one of these would you dispute? Just from a biblical perspective, without even getting into science. Which one of these elements would you dispute? I'm asking. Yes, this is a question for go ahead. Yes,
okay. I think they all fit the Bible. They don't seem contradictory, but it doesn't say, or do I? Am I missing it? That mutations are occurring and genetic mutations?
It doesn't say that, but we will get into that.
Okay.
But look at number four, for example. Would that comport with the Adam and Eve story? What do you think? Yes? No? Yes? So if we use the word ancestor to mean merely a human ancestor, then yes, it would. But that isn't what's meant here. So what we're talking about is an ancestor, an organismal ancestor. In other words, some remarkably minimalist organism was the ancestor of all living things. So that's what we mean. So in that respect, the reason I ask this question is because number four could be vague in some respects. So what we're talking about when we're talking about a last universal common ancestor means the ancestor of all living things, not just humans. So in that respect, absolutely the Bible would disagree with that. Because the Adam and Eve account explicitly states that Adam and Eve were not progeny of some other creatures. They were made whole cloth de novo. Doug, wait for the mic. There you go.
Thank you. Okay. The theory of evolution, there's different trains of thought, right, about whether there was one initial living cell that spawned life to everything, or if there was like an orchard. Can you respond to that a little bit?
Yeah, we will. The question is whether the theory of evolution exclusively has just one last universal common ancestor, or whether there are many. Did I get your question right?
Yeah.
The one last universal common ancestor is most frequently cited, but as time goes on, and part of the reason for this talk is that there have been changes in the way the theory of evolution has been posited, and some of those changes are important to know. So the answer to your question is, yes, there are some who believe there might have been multiple last universal common ancestors, that there wasn't just a single base of a tree, that there actually may have been multiple bases of a tree. And I will have a diagram showing that. So thank you for your question. Was I responsive to your question? Thank you. Yes, please. You have another question up front?
On that number four, I'm trying to think, you know, we look at God's creation as a series of, doesn't he work from an archetype, something like an original plan?
Yes.
And then he builds on it, and builds on it, and builds on it. And it almost fits number four, but not quite, you know.
It doesn't fit number four if you look at all of the other three together. So if it's if there's a gradual change through time, then God's pattern of creating individual types doesn't fit this. Yeah. Thank you. Was I responsive to your question?
Yeah.
Thank you. So now it's time for you to help me. What have you heard are the most popular arguments against evolution as you've heard it spoken? And I know everybody in here has heard them, and I know everybody in here has said them. So what do you, just off the top of your head, what are some of the best arguments or most popular arguments against the theory of evolution? Please, Gary.
I think number one, there just hasn't been, there's not enough time for evolution to work, particularly since the Big Bang replaced the eternal universe theory.
So there's not enough time on Earth?
There's not enough time in the universe, only being, what, 16.8 billion, 13.8?
So if there's billions of years, the argument against evolution would be that even given the billions of years age of the Earth, the billions of years age of the universe, there isn't enough time for evolution to occur.
The universe is not old enough.
The universe is not old enough. Okay.
Period.
Thank you. Look, I'll just let you see people raise their hands and jump on them.
In two words, Cambrian explosion. I can have thousands of definitive words about that.
So tell us a little bit about what you mean by Cambrian explosion.
Well, the sheer amount of different species and phyla that came in that could not have come in so fast by any explanation that's in accord with science, so many that a book would be very large to try to include them all.
Do you have a rough idea about when the Cambrian explosion occurred? I think it's like 550 million, 540 million years ago. Yeah, at a zero, that's fine. So I want to make sure I get your point correctly. Your point is that around 540, 550 million years ago, there was a rapid increase, a sudden presentation of new phyla, which are the groups very close to the top of the tree. So completely new body plans, completely new types, without any evidence of having anything before them. Do I understand your argument properly?
Yeah, even the evidence.
So some of the evidence that's been presented for that theory is, to account for that, is either insufficient or erroneous.
Yeah, one of the best arguers for creation is Dr. Stephen Meyer. And he explains about trilobites because it's one of the most common things that are still found now.
So there's the trilobite is one example that showed up all over the place at the same time with no historical reference in the fossil record. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi. I'd like to take maybe a little different point of view. To me, all first three of the characteristics, depending upon how you define these different words, could be acceptable to us as Christians. But let me explain that a little bit further.
Sure.
Like, for example, number three, survivor populations pass on characteristics. Conditions change. We see that. I mean, on a small time, limited time scale, we see that in our own families. And so on a short, if you consider this on that time of time scale, the variations in characteristics existing at any time, we can see that happening.
Sure.
Change in inheritable characteristics of populations over time. Now, I think you're implying there a long-term time, but on a short-term time, we can also see that happen. I think the real objection here comes in item four, where you talk about the last universal common ancestor. Now, when you talk about that, you are talking about long times. And in talking about long times, okay, then you said, well, what is a long time? And we've heard the word Cambrian explosion. But actually, evolution takes the idea of evolution takes it back much further than that. I mean, if you really want to look at the long time interval, you would take it back to the point where life was first scientifically, where they feel that life was first scientifically observed. And when was that? I mean, you've heard Hugh say, I think, it's about 3.8 billion years ago. And so if you take it from that point of view, I mean, that's what evolutionists really claim, that life started back at that point of time and evolved to where it is today. So that is, to me, the fundamental flaw, because there isn't evidence, we don't have evidence to show that that occurred. So I guess that's all I have to say.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. That's exactly what we were looking for.
Thanks. As you know, I'm an evolutionist. So can I say what is against evolution? All the arguments that I've heard are really based on time so far, and that's an interesting one, and evidence. And I just think we need to go to Scripture a lot. For instance, the word men for kinds is also used for God's intervention, especially for RTB. Yet men means parted. It's used in a chord of a guitar, for instance, or a string instrument. And it really talks about parting.
Can you get that mic closer?
Yeah, parting, not sudden and different. On time, before I go to answer, we need to realize that in the Bible, in day three, it says, usually says, and God said, let. In day three, it says, let the earth bring forth. That was different from all the other creation days, except day five, where it says, let the waters bring forth. What does that mean? We need to deal with that. Then as a basic RTD schema on the timeline for the first two verses, and God created the heavens and the earth, and then they end up at the end of the story, and God said, and God created the earth and the heavens, just opposite heavens, earth, heavens, in chapter 2, as a bookend, are not part of the creation story. Each creation day starts, says, and God said, let. You'll find that at each creation day. RTP puts first life, and really the first earth of the DNA, in a gap between verses 1 and 2, where people who know Hebrew just know that the first two verses are summary headings of what will happen. It's not creation at all. So we need to deal with that. That's basic. Now, to time...
Well, before you go any further,
yeah,
let me bring us back to the point here.
Right.
The question at bar is, what are the arguments, the popular arguments, against the theory of evolution? And I see where you're going, but we need to stick to that. So if what you're saying is in response to that and directly responsive, please continue. If not, we do have another section on what are the popular arguments for evolution.
Thank you. The last word I said was time, and I think that's where we've been dealing when you wanted to get it back on. But I had to bring in Scripture because a lot of us don't deal with Scripture well. we really need to get into Scripture. On time, I've mentioned to Mark and others, Mark Durham, that when evolution comes up, I'll bring up James Shapiro book that came back, it was in 2012, and it's a whole movement for extended evolutionary synthesis that deals with time. And the book Evolution in the 21st Century was a seminal book, in a way, in that we've looked at gradualism and Darwin, which is partially true, but it is not the mechanism. And he just says, guys, it's not the mechanism. And he comes up with a mechanism that shows when stress is added to a system, such as catastrophic things happening on Earth, where we find a lot of change, he says there are mechanisms in the DNA on transposable mobile elements that do allow quick change and respond to stressors in the environment. That DNA is a read-write system, not just a read system. It reads and changes. It reads from anyway, there's fast change. It reads from our sensory organisms and changes according to that. And that gives an answer that we need to start to deal with quick change, which they find in the record and evolutionists are dealing with. We deal with it. We call it a miracle. I call it design. He called it intelligent engineering until people got on him because they thought creationists like me and you were going to say Yahoo, and he called it natural engineering. But I call it design, and the word here is design. And they come up with a quick way based on what we know on DNA today for quick change. And that is important for time.
Okay, thank you. Have one in the back.
Yes, one of the main things that I have on evolution is the design. It has to be design, intelligent design. Evolution cannot account for the millions of programs on each animal or species. The birds, the structure of the birds, the bones are hollow. The designer had to know that he had to reduce weight. Many things that you can mention that they were designed. If you say evolution is true, then you deny that everything that we have, computers, cars, automobiles, airplanes, everything was, you don't believe that there was a design. They just evolved. My boss is an atheist, and one time I was telling him that the typewriter that he was working on, it was very beautiful design. He said, no, it evolved. I said, who evolved it? Anyway, that's my main point, that you cannot really erase the intelligent design, and that's what nature has, and it had to be a designer, and that was God.
Thank you. So as I understand what you're getting at there is that evolution, in your mind, presumes that there's no design, that it's accidental or random or undirected by an intelligence. Okay, thank you. All right.
I was just talking to an atheist about this either last night or Friday, but he was rebuking the arguments about chance. But what I was discussing with him was like, how come there's such complexity? Kind of like what he was saying, but it's an advancing complexity. And he was saying that random chance did that. No, there's guidance. If you look at the taxonomic trees, they just get more and more complex. And he said, mutations cause that. The good ones stick. Well, it seems like if it was just random chance, there'd be a lot of simpler creatures emerging simultaneously with the more complex ones. It doesn't make sense to me. So that's what I said to him.
Thank you.
What do you think of that?
Thank you. Mark, one more.
I think what the guys were talking about was information. And for huge amounts of information to come together to form an organism is basically impossible to happen accidentally. But that wasn't what I was going to bring up. Back on Cambrian explosion, following that, 300 or 550 million years ago, there's been a half dozen major extinction events. And that usually decimates 50 to 90% of all the species on the Earth. And they've been caused by various things, volcanic eruptions and comets and so on. And so how do you deal with that, you know? And then immediately, it happens very quickly, and then almost immediately after that, a few million years immediately, you get a whole new array of species, including megafauna, giant species. So it goes against the Darwinistic theory that evolution occurs slowly over time. These things are happening almost instantaneously. And so that's an argument against evolution.
Thank you. And now, when you say the species were, you said decimated, but I think you meant eliminated. I'm not sure which one you meant. Because decimate means to reduce it to one-tenth of its original size, or to reduce it by one-tenth. Mm-hmm. So is it that the number of species has been reduced, or the numbers within the species have been reduced by these extinction events?
Yeah, well, it starts at the top usually. The megafauna are the first to go, you know, whales and dinosaurs and things. Mm-hmm. They can't take the drastic changes of, you know, a comet hitting, you know, off the coast of Yucatan. Or
so we're talking an entire species because
an entire
of
species,
inability to survive.
Yes, okay. And many species would be exterminated. Yeah, and ecology, too, for interlocking species, you know, everything works together.
Yes.
Ecology would be destroyed, too, all over the Earth. And then God doesn't just make the new species. He makes the new ecological environment. And so that comes along with it immediately after. And so both of those are arguments against Darwinistic evolution.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Also, they have studied, scientists have studied species that have lived for a long time, and they can tell that the older examples of those species and the most recent ones, there have been no changes in the DNA. So there should be modifications throughout the long period of a species before you can say, oh, you can see the evolution has been occurring throughout it.
Right.
It's not a gradual change. It is consistent throughout that species, however millions of years that it survived, that there was nothing going on to make it modifications. So, you know, I remember when I was growing up, I lived near the Natural History Museum, and I would go there. It was free. I practically lived there. And they had these horses, the Dawn horse and the Modern horse and all these, and they lined them up, making them look like, oh, this led to this, led to this. But the fact is, there are many species in between that might have been smaller than the first one or bigger than the last one. And so they just lined it up to brainwash people to think this is what it means. It was deceptive. But the fact is that it was not representative, and there was each of those species was distinctly different. There was no gradual shifting.
So the fossil record was misrepresented to show progress that wasn't really present.
Right.
Thank you. All right, let me leave it at that. Did you have one more? Okay, one more. I don't want to cut anybody off because we didn't get over to that side. Thank you for your patience, by the way, while we await people getting to the microphone.
One thing that we all agree on, whether you're evolutionist or creationist, is that there was a beginning, and we call that the Big Bang. And scientists have found that right after the Big Bang, the only thing that we had was hydrogen and helium. And that eventually became the first stars. And when that star exploded, it created all the chemical elements that we have. So it's kind of like a scrambled egg. How do you unscramble an egg? And there's something they have, they call it the Goldilocks principle, where it has to be exactly not too hot, not too cold, and in order for something to happen. And my argument would be that it would take some type of intelligence to be able to do that.
So would you, is your argument then that the evolution not being intelligently guided is refuted by the fact that it appears to be, that life on Earth appears to be intelligently guided? Thank you. Okay, that's it for that for now. I have to move on. We have some good, very good people in this classroom. I can let the class run by itself. It's great. But I do want to move on to a couple of other things in order to maintain the theme of the session. So we've heard some interesting arguments against the theory of evolution. I'm not here to test those. What I want to do is just bring them up and let people hear each other. That we in this room who've been hearing these kinds of things for a while have some ideas. What are those ideas? We should be testing each other on them. We should be asking, are those still legitimate arguments? And if they are they sophisticated enough to withstand the opposition? So keep that in the back of your mind. Because the next question is, what have you heard as the most popular or effective arguments for evolution? Now, all the time that you're reading magazines, popular magazines, especially science magazines, especially biologically scientific magazines, anytime you watch a show on TV that it has animals in it or it talks about the history of life, they're going to give you arguments for evolution. And some of them, if you just leave them at face value, actually make sense. On their face, they make sense. But there's more to it than that. But what I'm curious about is, when you have heard popular arguments for the theory of evolution, what are those arguments? You've got to have them in your head. You can't argue against something if you don't know what you're arguing against. And we need to know, what are the strongest, most effective, or if nothing else, the most popular arguments for the theory of evolution that you've heard recently? Anybody? Got one over here?
With the fossil record, although there's quite a few against, the four that always strikes me.
Keep the mic up close, please.
When I'm reading an article discussing finds in geology, I see them able to date the layers of rocks by the kinds of fossils. So there is certainly some kind of progression that's very well seen and collaborated to the extent where people can date areas in across an entire continent by these changes of the fossils. So it isn't one fossil that was a half a billion years ago and it's the same exact thing today. They can see specific changes and a very orderly arrangement in those changes. So there is something going on. When I read those articles, at least at face value, there's something many scientists are identifying.
Thank you.
One of the evolution's comment is, there is no God. If there's no God, there can't be a creation. The only alternative is evolution.
So the one argument for evolution is that presuming the absence of a creator, it's the only game in town.
Right, which the problem with that is there is no creator, there is no God. That's extremely problematic and highly rebuttable.
Okay, so right now what we want to stick to is, what are the popular arguments for evolution? Thank you very much for that one. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, a quick comment, you know, there are theistic evolutionists, you know, and I'm kind of in between that now. I'm undecided now. I used to reject theistic evolution. I don't accept it, but I'm starting to lean toward that way. But anyway, it's just so popular, you know. I think that's probably the main reason that it's caught on. It's kind of like a revolving door that won't stop. You know, these scientists are afraid to speak out against it, you know. So that's part of the reason, I think, that that's a pro reason.
Thank you. Now, that's fascinating because That's not a scientific reason, but it is a reason. So there is a sociological component to this, and you hit on it. We could also use that same sociological component to talk about Christianity. So we could say, well, the reason that, part of the reason, that evolution is so popular is that it's so popular. Everybody says it's true, and if everybody else is saying it's true, then I'm going to too. It's sort of a bandwagon effect. And then there are other arguments, such, and then they're not really fallacious arguments, they're actual arguments that if the paradigm, this grand theory of evolution, is what's guiding research and funding research, how would a researcher go against it and still get funding? So there's a sociological and an economic problem. Both of them are very good arguments for evolution. I'm going to keep studying evolution because it's fruitful. Practical. Thank you. Yes, sir. Arguments for evolution.
Yeah, for. I think one of the best argument has to do with quantum theory. That in that there's two different types of physics. There's the E equals MC squared, which is the physics that we know happens all the time, every time. But in the quantum world, it doesn't necessarily have to happen. It can happen and it can't happen. It's random. And that there is something within the electron that is able to on its own. There's something there that they call some type of consciousness in the material part. It not necessarily has to be a god, but the structure of the atom does it on its own.
So help me understand how does that advance the evolutionary theory?
Well, that when the Big Bang happened, it's within the structure of the physical part of the explosion. It just, everything that we see happens. It's kind of like population. It just happens. But it's not random.
Okay, so it's not random, but there seems to be a direction, and it seems to be inherent at even the most basic fundamental level of the quantum level.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to make a couple points. First of all, we can't confuse the beginning of the universe with the beginning of life. The beginning of the universe is a completely inorganic phenomenon. Hydrogen, helium, those things, there's no life associated with them. Life did not, after we proceed past the Big Bang and creation of the solar system and the Earth, we finally get land, and then the question is, when does life start? And the real question here goes back to from those non-life species, how does life begin? That is, how does your CO2 and H2O and minerals, what argument is there to get life out of that? And the fact is, that's missing. That data to show the beginning of this beginning of life is missing.
And where does the evolution
come from? That's weakness again. Okay, but now the argument for, basically the argument for evolution is all these pictures you see where you see the very minute microbes and things that they claim continue to grow in complexity up until we see humans today. And actually, the most recent data showing the evolution, I think, is if you look at the submicrobial world, like diseases and things like this, where viruses, where they can change their properties in a matter of several generations. We see that in the bacteria producing drugs. That's why your drugs no longer become effective, because these bugs can change their characteristics so quickly. So to me, the best argument for evolution is this picture of continually changing nature of the species. But to answer that, of course, is that how far do these evolutionary changes actually take you as you go from one type of bacteria to another? And it's a limited change. And so that's the weakness in that argument, but the strongest argument for it is the vast development that we see of life, starting from the microbes up to human life. Now, in that respect also, we go back to the... if that evolution is not effective, how did life come out? And we see biblically that life started at several points, several types of life that Hughes talked about. The beginning of life and the plant type species, and then you go on to the soulish creatures, and finally man. So, and that's where the argument for God comes in.
Thank you. Gary, and then we have Mark.
At the risk of sounding flip, the most popular and arguably then the most effective argument for the theory of evolution is that my high school science teacher told me it so. And they were obviously taught by people that know. They got it at college. So the bottom line is that then everybody knows, or most everybody knows, that it's true. And that it's beyond argument. So I've got argument that's both popular and effective.
Sure.
We can come up with all kinds of scientific arguments.
And effective, yes.
We can come up with all kinds of scientific arguments against what the scientists have been teaching, but they're still teaching evolution the old way in high school, in their textbooks.
Thank you. So that ends up being a sociological argument. It does. It is a sociological argument. Because it's changing a culture. It's creating a culture and changing a culture. Was there a question in the back?
I'll get to the sociological argument, but for me, the best pro-evolution argument is the Bible again itself, Genesis 1. I'll just give a couple examples. Instead of life beginning...
Please make them quick, because I don't have much time left.
Yeah, every time I speak, I guess I get the word quick.
Yes, there's a reason for it.
But there's information to come out. And the information is that day 3 is first life. There's 3 different types of life there, not between a verse and verses 1 and 2. Another example would be in day 6, there's 2 parts. The first part has a creeper. The earth has been called in Hebrew Haaretz until that time. And that time is the creeper. Upon the earth is called Ha-Adam. We need to pay attention to Adam being there. Ha-Adamah, excuse me. And then it changes to Ha-Aretz afterwards. There is progression shown. We've all agreed that progression is there. And there's very specific progression, not in Hugh Ross's and RTB's progression, which I don't think follows Hebrew at all, but Gerald Schroeder, who speaks Hebrew and who is a scientist, I think has excellent progression that's testable.
So is the argument then that...
that's pro-evolution.
That the Bible itself, when properly interpreted, would tell us that life originated, God created it, but life originated...
In day 3.
Pardon me?
In day 3.
And that he did it in gradual steps that would look like what the evolutionists say.
Be careful of the word gradual. Again, that should be attacked.
Darwin, okay, well then explain it. So I want to make sure I'm getting your
point. Progressive steps.
Progressive steps.
Yeah.
So does that mean big leaps at sometimes?
Sometimes, yes.
Okay,
and especially it's found that catastrophism, where catastrophes come, a meteor hits. For Schroeder, it just happens that each day from 4 to 5, 5 to 6, et cetera, is a catastrophic event in history. It just happened that way. And that's when evolution in the 21st century and those who believe in extended evolutionary synthesis say there's great change. About 80% of our DNA is transposable multiple elements, and we need to pay attention to how the DNA changes. Now to the sociological argument, which I think is the huge one, and we've hit on it twice here. We say the Bible told us so. Some people say our teacher told us so, and we really need to search the evidence in both. For the sociological, in 1950, Julian Huxley, who is the grandson of Aldous Huxley, absolutely denigrated Christianity and for the first time in a big way connected atheism to evolution and said, we Christians just believe in a Devonized father basically as a crutch. We did not have a good argument, but ever since then, the church has been fighting evolution, really before then, but ever since then. But I can tell you now, if you go to our Christians, who are scientists who are Christians, who convene at the American Scientific Affiliation, most of them will be theistic evolutionists praising God for design. Mm-hmm. BioLogos, a young organization, much younger than RTB, started by the head of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, has grown in its base and its funding to where now it becomes second to RTB and with all the organizations. So we need to pay attention to Christians who are looking at design, but especially the Bible. We need to go beyond, well, the Bible just told me, so we need to really look and study.
Thank you. Yes, we do need to go beyond that, absolutely. We're almost getting near the time to be done. Did you want? All right, one more quick.
We probably need to distinguish micro from macro evolution. If we go there eventually. The other thing, you know, you're asking for pro. There is some genetic information that's pro evolution. You know, for instance, if you look at the chromosomes on a chimpanzee versus a human. Chromosome 24, I believe it is, it appears that most of it combined with chromosome 23 in the chimpanzee to make a human. So genetically, it does appear that way. There is a lot of the genes are missing when they fuse together, if that happened. But then again, it could also be God's working with the genetics that happened, because it was so traumatic. A genetic change like that, it would generally kill any organism. But there it is. You know, you see some genetic evidence that humans are closely evolutionarily related to chimpanzees because of that chromosome 23 and 24.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you. These are interesting because how often do we listen to each other give arguments for evolution? We should actually be listening very often to that, because we don't really know what we're talking about until we hear what the people who disagree with us believe. And the theory of evolution is so enormously comprehensive. The field of biology is so unfathomably comprehensive that there are many facts that are undisputably true within the biological realm. We get all sorts of fantastic things from that. Everything from the food we have to the medicines we get, and much more. The question is, how are we interpreting some of those data? And do those data say this, or do those data say that? So that's one of the things I want to make sure that we understand, is that A, if you do not agree that evolution is true, that doesn't mean you have to discount all of the evidence. There's plenty of stuff that's being said in experiments conducted that are giving the truth. They're showing what God did. They're showing what the reality of the world is. And if we discount those evidence, we will be looked at as fools. Why? Because we would be. Because if they come up with data that are absolutely conclusive, absolutely show that this particular biochemical pathway will result in this predictably and repeatably, there's no reason to argue with that. There's no reason to have a dispute about it. The question is, what do these mean? There's a question in the back, please.
Just a statement that overall, God is sovereign, from the microorganisms to the planets to the universe. He's overall sovereign, and he created the details and the whole picture, and we definitely have something to praise God about, and that we have hope in God that one day we'll be in heaven in the big picture. And whether it's progressively or gradually, he did it all. And that's the bottom line.
Thank you. Thank you. I was talking with a group of men last Wednesday and was talking about how we go through the Bible and learn, and that each of us believes we know things that and will end up being not true. And that when we get to heaven and God says, so what did you believe? And then we're going to say, well, I believe this. He's going to say, you believe what? that we have such incomplete knowledge that we need to be very humble about that. So let me move on, because we only have a few minutes, and I do want to get into a little bit of the differences among some of the versions of evolution. First of all, I mentioned earlier that evolution is this enormous program. It is bigger than any one of us in this room thinks. It has so many places that it goes, and so many applications, putative or otherwise, that it's almost impossible to really grab a hold of it and explain it. What we can do, though, is get some very basic ideas about how some of it has progressed or changed, so that at least we understand that it's not necessarily all Darwinism. In fact, Darwinism is sort of obsolete. That many, many scientists today believe Darwin was just wrong in some areas and just right in other areas. So let's kind of look at that and see what we come up with here. So back to Darwin, you see the little diagram in the upper right there. All creatures have descended from the original primordial life form, whatever that was. He had his ideas, but he wasn't too clear on it. Descent with modification occurs. So from this original creature, it multiplied, and then as its descendants moved on, it modified and became more and more ramified, so that you have this tree of life. Nature kills off the weak and preserves the strong as they continue to modify in small increments. It's called what? Natural selection, survival of the fittest. Yeah, these terms are terms of art. They use them, and sometimes they use them in ways that I think are inappropriate. We may be able to get into that sometime. But for now, we'll just talk about what Darwin thought. So natural selection is the killing off of the weak and the preservation of the strong. Darwin did not know about genetics. That's extremely important to remember. Darwin could never give an explanation for the modifications. What animal did Darwin look at that made him think that there was an original single creature? What animal was that? Please.
Finches.
Finches?
And pigeons.
Finches and pigeons. The one animal that he talked about that led him to this theory was pigeons.
Okay. Now, Finch.
No, it wasn't the finch. The finch came afterwards. The finch was an afterthought. It was something that he came up with later on. But remember that Darwin raised pigeons. And so did everybody else, by the way, at that time. As a matter of fact, in the 1850s, the Queen of England had her own set of pigeons. And it was a big deal. You raise pigeons, some people made a lot of money on them. They made them for communication. They raced them. They had racing pigeons. They breeded them for racing. So Darwin was looking at how these breeding processes worked, but he found out something very interesting in the process. He found that no matter how much breeding they did all over England and all over everywhere else they could find, that somehow the breeds would end up coming back, some of the breeds would end up coming back to the original type. And he thought, you know, if these all come back from one original type, then all of the creatures in the entire world go back to an original type. So he spends his first 70 or 80 pages in The Origin of Species just talking about pigeons. I don't know if you've read the thing. It's pretty doggone big. But you get the hint that he really cared about pigeons. And that really was what drove him to this theory. Is that he believed if there's a regression to the mean, if they go back to this original plan, that all of the life would do the same thing, back smaller and smaller groups to this final last universal common ancestor. So this is a Xerox copy, if you will, of part of his notebook where he says, I think, and then he writes out the number one at the bottom, which is the original, and then it goes up and it branches out. Of course, the branches are theoretical. He's believing them to be true, and that's the nature of his theory. Even the most advanced evolutionists today, the most sophisticated ones, who would say, well, Darwin didn't know about genetics, so he was limited, will still agree on the last universal common ancestor, or a multiple of them, will still agree that descent with modification is the way that things happen. The question is, how fast did it happen? And we'll still agree that natural selection plays a big role in the guidance of the tree of life. What creatures will survive and what won't? And why do they mutate in the way they do?
Can you read that, Mark?
No, I can't read it. I actually don't know what it says.
Okay. On the top it says, I think.
It definitely says that.
Anybody read it?
No, it is legible in its original form. You can go online and look at it, and you can actually read what he says. This is just a very small picture of it, so I apologize for that. I wasn't really expecting to be able to talk too much about it. But it's kind of neat to see what the original thing was and why he came up with what he came up with. It was not a stupid idea. It really was not a stupid idea. What he was trying to do is to explain the diversity of life in nature. A very wise thing to try to do. So what follows that? Yes, sir.
Not a stupid idea, but he admitted the real flaw that he couldn't answer was that origin of that common ancestor. That is still the major flaw that people cannot address, not answer.
Well, he... The question that was posed, the comment was posed, was that he admitted that one of the flaws in his argument or his theory was this last universal common ancestor and how did it get there. He actually, that was one of his problems. Another one of his problems was how do you get these modifications? How do you get the descent with modification? He had no explanation for that. And he even said, if you can't figure out a way for any of these systems or organisms to arrive in a stepwise fashion, then my theory caves in. Now, we won't get more into this, but I do want to say that Darwin was a magnificent rhetorician. When he wrote, he wasn't writing merely as a scientist. He was writing to convince people of something. It wasn't just, here's the data, here's my interpretation of it. He was trying to persuade people to believe a certain thing. What the reasons behind that were, I don't know. There are lots of theories on that. But the point is that he knew in the back of his mind that there were counter arguments to his theory, one of which was, well, where is this last universal common ancestor? And the next one was, how can I prove that the eye, for example, is one of his things he liked to look at. How did this marvelous eye come in steps? And then, of course, he talked about all of the organs and all of the systems, much of which he knew and much of which he did not. I'm not going to take any more questions right now. I'm going to move on here. Neo-Darwinism, which is the next form of Darwinism that came in around 1930s, 1940s, where genetics started to really have an effect, where we understood genetics much more and the genetic boom began. At that point, scientists were able to look at progressive modification say, you know what? The genes are what's causing this to happen. We actually now have some biochemical pathway that we can look at. We need to explore it more, and it wasn't for decades after that that they realized what the DNA molecule was all about. But this is what occurred next. So Darwinism was held in terms of things like descent with modification, natural selection, a universal common ancestor that we all descended from one or more very fundamentally basic organisms. But that genetic modifications were the mechanism. And these genetic modifications would become stuff of research for the next 90, 100 years, less than that maybe. At first there was a belief that there was a last universal common ancestor. That belief started to dissipate though, because as the genetic research continued, particularly in the 1970s and 1980s, they realized that there were breaks. There were breaks in the lineages. And that became a problem. So one of the very things that was argued against evolution up front, which is from the fossil record, hey, there's these giant gaps. Why are these giant gaps there? There should be a real smooth continuity of the creatures. Now appeared in the genetic record that there were these gaps. When I was doing the research for this, I was captured by a person who was not a creationist, and he said that what's been really pushing a lot of evolution theory in the past 25 years has been the cracks in the explanations of how the diversity occurred. That even the biochemical explanations are starting to run into some very serious problems, and we have to come up with something else. That's something else we'll describe in a minute. But for now, we need to realize that Darwinism is no longer exclusively adopted. This so-called modern synthesis, which is a bringing in of genetics and combining it with the original Darwinian explanations, is more current than Darwinism. So when you talk to somebody, you say, well, I'm going to talk to you about what I believe to be neo-Darwinism or the modern synthesis of genetics and Darwin. So in this neo-Darwinian modern synthesis, the tree of life looks more like a very simplified version that you see on the screen. You have these three broad, the broadest categories of bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotes. We're among the eukaryotes. The animals are. And the tree starts to ramify. There are more and more branches as time goes on. But it does go back to a common ancestor that's still preserved in the neo-Darwinian or the modern synthesis that probably will never disappear. If it did, that there was no universal common ancestor or set of ancestors, you would not have evolution anymore as we've known it. Pardon me? We don't know. Nobody knows. They don't know what the last universal common ancestor is or would be. That's still an issue of primary concern in the theory of evolution is, what did that first creature look like? Was it merely something that was partly alive? Was it, how many proteins did it have? Was it RNA that started it? Was it DNA that started? Well, it can't be DNA because DNA is really a mess and you can't make that easily. And so that origins problem is absolutely completely plaguing to evolution theory under any of its incarnations.
Do you know the fundamental difference between those three main branches?
Do I know them?
Yeah, I mean, what makes a eukaryote, well, okay, I have some idea. Different.
How is eukaryotes defined to be different from the archaea and the bacteria? We have three main branches. Do you know what's involved in that?
We have a resident biologist. I'd like to have explain that. Would you please do that?
Yeah, let's
have the mic. So the question is, we have these three different groupings up here. What's the difference among them?
Well, the eukaryotes are the more advanced cells, you know, the microcells in your body, for instance. We're eukaryotes. And the larger cells, and they have a nucleus. You know, the DNA is separated, and a lot of other cellular inclusions. Whereas the archaea and bacteria are prokaryotes. It's not written up there, but that means that they're, I hate to use the words, more simple cells, but they're still extremely complex. You know, a bacteria is extremely complex, but they do not have all those little inclusions in their cell, and so they're a lower, on an evolutionary sense, they're just less advanced than the eukaryote. But you know, in terms of creation, they're all very complex.
But the prokaryotes are both bacteria and archaea. Bacteria
and archaea, it's mostly the cell wall and the chemicals within the cell. They're genetically quite different. So some people would argue they should be stuck together, but and they used to be, but they separated them, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. So, but they're both bacteria-like. It's just mainly cell wall, cell membrane, and chemicals within the cells.
So, Mark, are the prokaryotes single-cell organisms?
Yeah, all the prokaryotes are single cells. Good point, Mark. And the eukaryotes can be single cells. See, it says up there protiste at the top, you know, like a protista. And those are single cells. But then you get the plants, animals, and fungi. Those are multicellular. They have tissue. Okay?
Thank you very much. Now, in the next couple of minutes, I'm going to try to get through to the last part. Steve mentioned the extended evolutionary synthesis. I just came across this probably in the past few months. I didn't really know what this was about. And I was curious, well, what is this extended evolutionary synthesis? This extended evolutionary synthesis is a program. It's a large research program that describes a new way of looking at evolution that still encompasses the notion that there is a last universal common ancestor or ancestors. They're not sure about that, so they're very clear. We don't know whether it's one or many, probably many, but maybe just one. The problem with having only one is that if you have only one, then that DNA should be in everything. There should be some trace all the way back to that, and that isn't present. It does not exist. There are things called orphan genes and other reasons that we know that all the living things do not genetically look back to a single. That's why that's being abandoned. It adds that there's things like constructive development, meaning, as they describe it here, condition-dependent gene expression. Now, what that means is we have genes in our bodies. And so the gene is one part of the structure of our DNA. And so DNA codes for proteins and for other things in the cells. And so when we have condition-dependent gene expression, those genes can be turned on and off. So, and they are turned on and off. Some there are other systems that say, okay, gene that makes things in the fetus, turn on now. And then when it's no longer a fetus, turn off now. So there's things that the gene is constantly being turned on and off by these things. Now what goes on in the extended evolutionary synthesis is that these signals can come from the environment as well. That is not a problem because it has actually been shown to be true. That there are some signals that come from the environment that cause us to turn on and off certain genes in our bodies. You can see it all over the place with adaptation. Things change, you know. People who go up into cold climates, what happens to their earwax? It changes. Okay, that's exactly what's a condition-dependent gene expression. The genes for earwax change. That's not a big problem. However, what this constructive development means is that there's much more of this going on than people realize. It's not just a straightforward inheritance, and these inherited mutations create new species, and these new species create new species in bigger orders. but that there is an interplay between the environment and the genetics that causes changes, which is where we go to number two here, that reciprocal causation, that organisms affect their environments, which affect them, which affects their environments in a reciprocal cycle. So there's this interplay between the organism and their environment such that they both change each other epigenetically. So if the fish have small mouths and they only eat certain parts of the environment and those things disappear, then they change. You know, there are some genes are switched off and other genes are switched on to change the mandible size, which is already built into their code, then the environment can change too, because now they're not consuming a particular part of the environment, they're consuming something else. And so other factors in that environment change as a result, which causes all sorts of ripple effects, which changes ecologies. So these ecologies have within them other evolutionary changes that are a result of these epigenetic conditions. And the question there is, how fast does it occur? Some argue that it happens very quickly. There's no evidence of that directly, but that's what they're still working on. If you go to evolutionary synthesis, extendedevolutionarysynthesis.com, they have at the bottom of their website a beautiful table that has some descriptions of predictions they make. I've looked at that. Some of them are actually pretty interesting. Some of them to me are circular. You know, okay, something will work and it won't die. Okay, so what? That's not very interesting to me. So my point here is that this is in some respects, revolutionary view of evolution, even though the extended evolutionary synthesis adherents will argue it is not a revolution. And this is what's interesting about the EES, is that there are many people in the old guard who say EES is a threat, because what they're trying to do is revolutionize the old modern synthesis. Modern synthesis as being old. And the EES people are saying, no, but we are willing to take a radical look at it. That maybe what you think is what causes these changes isn't the only thing. There are other things, like maybe natural selection doesn't have as much effect as you think it does. Maybe these epigenetic changes have far more, and their effects on their environment have far more, and can cause changes you never thought of. So we're out of time now. I need to honor that. But this has been a very brief survey to let us see how did evolutionary theory start, how has it progressed, and recognizing that it's vastly greater than anything that I could explain to you in an hour, that we have in this room different ideas on how we would disagree with evolution, why we should accept evolution, or at least look at it as maybe possibly true from a theistic viewpoint, scientific viewpoint, sociological viewpoint, and all of these things we need to consider when we're talking with each other, lest we become an echo chamber, only repeating the same thing over and over again because we've heard it 1,000 times. So let me close us in prayer, and I hope that this helps you. Lord, thank you for this magnificent universe, for this unfathomable diversity of life, and for the minds you gave us to explore them. Thank you that you gave us the scriptures to be specific about what we should be understanding. Help us to be wise in understanding it, Lord. Give us the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, to understand your scriptures wisely and work on them properly. And also, Lord, to be open-minded to science, whatever it leads, to help us as well. You made the universe, Lord. May we see your hand in it through science and through the proper interpretations of the evidence. Bless our friends, Lord, and our brothers and sisters in this room as they go forward this next week. May they bring glory to you in whatever they do. And, Lord, I pray that somehow somebody will come into their life to be able to share Christ with, and to enjoy that beauty of seeing somebody come to Christ, or at least start them on their way. We thank you in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you very much.